So today's passage is taken from Luke chapter 11, verses 29 to 36, and it's on the second page of your handout. As the crowds increased, Jesus said, "This is a wicked generation. It asks for a sign, but none will be given it except the sign of Jonah. For as Jonah was assigned to the Ninevites, so also will be the Son of Man to this generation. The Queen of the South will rise at the judgment with the people of this generation and condemn them, for she came from the ends of the earth to listen to Solomon's wisdom, and now something greater than Solomon is here. The men of Nineveh will stand up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and now something greater than Jonah is here. No one lights a lamp and puts it in place where it will be hidden, or under a bowl. Instead, they put it on the stand, so that those who come in may see the light. Your eye is the lamp of your body. When your eyes are healthy, your whole body also is full of light. But when they are unhealthy, your body also is full of darkness. See to it then that the light within you is not darkness. Therefore, if your whole body is full of light, and no part of it dark, it will be just as full of light as when the lamp shines in its light on you."
Thank you very much, Rachel. Let me add my welcome to Rachel's welcome. We're in Luke 11 today. It's printed on your sheet, and we'll be looking at the passage now. In 1999, Britney Spears entered the scene. She bellowed out the line, "Give me a sign," as she began her march towards the top of the charts, the front cover of Smash Hits, and a fortune of almost $200 million. "Give me a sign." And it's not just Britney Spears who's looking for a sign. We all demand proof, don't we? From the bank manager to the playground, where the kid boasts that he can do more keepy-uppies than anyone else in the class. Captains of industry too, take Lord Sugar, Baron of Clapton. His slightly comical approach is to gather a group of extremely ambitious 20-somethings and supremely confident 20-somethings and ask them to back up the outrageous claims that they make about themselves. Phone hacking juries, investors, football supporters, they're all asking for the same thing. Show us a sign, prove to us that the claims stack up, that what you say is actually true. And it was actually no different in first century Palestine. It's sometimes thought that this analytical, sophisticated, slightly annoying method of asking for proof for absolutely everything is some sort of modern idea that people in times gone by were a bit slow on the uptake or didn't know to ask for a good proof. Well, that's nothing more than chronological snobbery. We see in today's passage that we read that the internet-deprived people of Jesus' day were actually no different from us at all. We saw last week, didn't we, that Jesus was speaking to crowds. He was drawing crowds of people as he taught and as he preached in the synagogue and in the open air. And we saw that miracles went hand in hand with his teaching. Earlier in this chapter, Jesus had restored a man who had been demon-possessed with an evil spirit, a madman stilled right before the very eyes of the crowd. And some of the crowd were rightly amazed. Others tried to discredit Jesus and called him evil. But others asked for exactly the same thing that we ask for today, for hard proof. Could Jesus have been demon-possessed? Well, he addresses that question in verses 14 to 18, using a metaphor about a strong man in a house, which we'll not go into today. In this section, however, he directs our attention to those seeking hard proof. And it's a bit surprising that Jesus doesn't use metaphors or stories to address the crowd and to appeal to the crowd. He doesn't gently and analytically lead them through the evidence. He simply addresses the crowd head on and calls them wicked, a wicked generation. It's really shocking. At verse 29, as the crowds increased, Jesus said, "This is a wicked generation. It asks for a sign." We assume that that signs and proof are good things, don't we? Proof is for moderates, for rational people. But Jesus' response here is to wait until the crowds are almost at critical mass and then to address them as evil. Only a wicked generation looks for a sign. So we're left asking, aren't we, what's going on in this passage? Why is Jesus turning on the crowd at this stage? Well, for starters, I don't think that Jesus is saying here that it's wrong to ask for proof per se. What he is saying, though, that it's wrong for this particular crowd to ask it of him. When you have the ruler of the universe in your midst, it's completely wrong to say to him that he has to do a magic trick before he's allowed to command your attention. And it's pretty striking that the term Master of the Universe appears to be the very title that Jesus has applied to himself, the title that he's chosen. He refers to himself in the passage as the Son of Man, the same Son of Man spoken of in the Old Testament book of Daniel, the Son of Man who will be given dominion and glory and who will rule over a kingdom of all peoples, nations and languages. That's everybody. Jesus' listeners would have got immediately the significance of using this title. But even if they didn't, Jesus drives home the point, doesn't he? He states clearly that he's considerably more important than King Solomon in all his wisdom, or the famous prophet Jonah. A few hundred years earlier, God had sent Jonah to the Ninevites, a hostile city in modern-day Iraq, with a warning for the people to turn from their ways or face God's judgment. And much to Jonah's surprise, the people of Nineveh actually listened to that message and turned from their ways and were spared God's judgment. The wicked generation listened and they were saved. So we've got the people of Nineveh. We've also got the Queen of Sheba and Solomon. Queen of Sheba, Queen of the South. She came from the ends of the earth to come and listen to Solomon's wisdom. Went to inordinate lengths to sit and to listen. So actually Jesus' point in the first half of today's passage is dead simple. It's really direct and it's quite sobering. Essentially Jesus is saying that he's a much bigger deal than King Solomon and a much bigger deal than Jonah, men who commanded royalty, men who saved cities from destruction. Jesus says, "I command everything, yet here you are refusing to acknowledge me and refusing to listen to me because I can't and I refuse to perform a party trick for you." Jesus doesn't commend the crowd for their keen mind or for their excellent questions. He points out that the response is wrong and it's wholly unreasonable. It's also dangerous. In fact, Jesus warns the crowd that on the day of the judgment, there will be a queen and a city full of rebellious people queuing up to give evidence against them. We see in verse 31, if you look down, the Queen of the South will rise up at the judgment with the people of this generation and condemn them, for she came from the ends of the earth to listen to Solomon's wisdom, and now something greater than Solomon is here. It's the wrong way round. A crowd of people from the most religious country on the planet at that time are having evidence given against them by a foreigner queen, someone giving queen's evidence against the people. They stubbornly refuse to listen, she will say. And verse 32, the men of Nineveh are just the same. The men of Nineveh will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and now something greater than Jonah is here. A group of pagans and a group of particularly wicked pagans will be in the witness box against the religious folk of Jesus' day. "We heeded the warning and we repented," they'll say. "And this crowd have heard it firsthand and they've refused to listen." So Jesus starts off the passage with a rebuke to the crowd. And how much more of a rebuke to then compare the people unfavourably to the people of Nineveh? According to Jesus, quite simply, some of the worst characters in the history of creation will be entering God's kingdom in the place of God's own people. I hope that the shock isn't lost on us. Jesus gives a swinging warning and a swinging rebuke to the crowd. Don't treat me like a tax collector or like a scam artist. Listen to me, and listen to me without demanding immediate proof. So after this first warning, Jesus follows it with a second warning. Second warning to the crowds. It's about darkness and light. Be careful, Jesus says, that you don't get them mixed up. Darkness and light. Be careful you don't get them mixed up. I guess in Jesus' day, it wasn't a case of walking into a dark room and flicking the light switch or flicking the switch on your iPhone that you can use from the comfort of your sofa to turn on the lights in your house. I don't have one, I just like to say. It was much more involved. Think power cut in the middle of winter. Back then, it was a three-stage process to getting the lights on. First, you had to find a lamp. Then you had to find a way of lighting the lamp. And then you had to find a way of getting the lamp as high as you could, get the ladder out, so that it gave as much light as possible to anyone who walked through the door. Wouldn't it be ludicrous if you went to the bother of doing all that, getting the ladder out, you know, hanging the light, making sure it didn't break and burn down the house, and have the light lovely and sort of set up and providing light, and then you went and hid it under a basket or behind a wall or outside the house? I don't know what the equivalent for us is. Would it be running around and ripping the light switches out of the wall? Would it be unscrewing the bulbs in the house and throwing them in the bin? It would be a ludicrous thing to do, wouldn't it? With light, when you're in a dark place, you want to get the lights on and make the most of them. You want to get the dimmer switches up. You want to get the little light shades just angled just right and make sure that every room in the house has light to it, so you're not fumbling around in the dark and tripping over yourself. It's pretty clear in the context of this chapter that Jesus is drawing a parallel between himself and his teaching on the one hand and the concept of light and sight on the other. Jesus' teaching on the one hand and light and sight on the other. Ignoring Jesus' teaching would be as foolish as running around, taking the bulbs and throwing them in the bin. And it's not the first time that Luke has used light to talk about Jesus. Zechariah's prophecy in chapter 1 talked of God bringing light to the people, and we are told that the glory of God shone all around when angels attended at the birth of Jesus, told at the start of the book. Don't ignore the light, don't smother it, is the first command in the second section of today's reading. But then there's a second command in this part of the text, and that is get your eyes tested. If you've got poor vision, you're not going to take in the light, regardless of how many bulbs there are in the house and how many strobe lights you've got shining around. You'll effectively be sitting in the dark. Don't confuse light for darkness, or you'll lose out and you'll be put in danger. As Jesus sees it, it's really quite simple. Our eyes have got to take in something. They're either going to take in the darkness or they're going to take in the light. And we need to make sure that our eyes are focused on the light. So a string of quite stern warnings from today's passage, all in a row. Jesus spared nothing from the crowd and just gave it to them with a succession of three warnings. How are we supposed to apply this passage and apply Luke 11 in our lives today? Well, I think it's important to acknowledge, first of all, that we've all got questions for Jesus, don't we? Some will have better questions than others. Some of us are believers and have questions. Others will be non-believers. If you are a non-believer and you've got questions, look at your sheet and sign up on a Christianity Explored course, a course specifically designed to have any questions thrown to the front that you can think up. We've all got questions, and I think it's okay to ask questions. But I think at the same time, the passage is a wake-up call to those who look at Jesus and demand some sort of hard evidence before even entertaining the idea of listening to what he has to say. I've heard it plenty of times from friends that they'd be far more amenable to believing in Jesus and considering his claims if God would just give a sign. Just give us a sign and we'll believe. And the argument goes that it was easier for people in Jesus' day. It was easier for the crowds that he spoke to. They saw the evidence firsthand. and we have to take it secondhand. And I hope that this passage shows us that that thinking is actually shows up our human nature for what it is. By this stage, Jesus had performed dozens of miracles in front of crowds just like this crowd, and his generation still weren't convinced. So if you're not a believer and you're asking that question, just give us a sign. And just note that the people of Jesus' day saw the miracles and they still didn't believe. And I'd suggest to you that even if Jesus was to walk down the stairs of Amber and to walk into this darkened basement room in which I stand and in which you sit and perform a miracle in front of our eyes, it still might not be enough to convince you. And what about those of us who've already taken that step of faith? Maybe those of us who are tempted to give up and to stop believing. It can be really easy, can't it, to turn on the news, to look through the papers and to read of wars and kidnappings and corruption and death. And just to think, I'm not really sure that God's in control. I'm not really sure he exists, or at least not as master of the universe, the way the Son of Man was supposed to. Well, Luke's gospel is designed so that the reader may have certainty about the teaching of Jesus. We have the evidence written down in Luke's gospel and in the other gospels. We've got it recorded for us. And as we read and recall the accounts in Luke's gospel and elsewhere, we're really left with very little capacity to doubt the claims of Jesus. The evidence is staring us in the face. And if we switch back to the crowd for a moment and look at verse 29, on the sheet, it's not quite true that Jesus has sent the crowds away, sent them packing empty-handed without a sign. He did promise one such sign, a sign he calls the sign of Jonah. Now Jonah, we mentioned, rescued the people of Nineveh, but before he did so, he went through an elaborate process of saying no to God, running away in the opposite direction, getting onto a boat, being thrown off the boat by the ship's crew, and being swallowed by a large fish, where he stayed for 3 days until he was spat up and given his life back. Now, the sign of Jonah could be a reference to Jesus and his death and resurrection, or it could simply be a reference to Jesus' teaching. We're not quite sure. It's clear from the passage that when Jesus compares the crowd with the people of Nineveh or with the Queen of Sheba, he expects there to be enough evidence there for people to believe without a sign. But it's also clear that the people standing in front of Jesus would soon live through the biggest miracle that's ever been performed, and given evidence as hard as it comes. One former Lord Chief Justice even went as far as to say that in terms of the evidence on which it stands, both positive and negative, factual and circumstantial, no intelligent jury in the world could fail to bring in a verdict that the resurrection story is true. For the people of that day, and for the people of our generation, there can be no bigger proof around. Jesus may rebuke, but he doesn't leave us guessing. He doesn't send us away empty-handed. Well, another thing to note is that the book of Luke was written to Theophilus. It's written to Theophilus so that he may have certainty about the gospel. And I suppose in Theophilus' own walk, he will come across many religious folks who don't accept the claims of Jesus, who know their Bible but who don't respond to God. They know about Solomon, they know about Jonah, but they reject Jesus. I suppose Luke is saying here, isn't he, don't be surprised, Theophilus. The problem isn't with the message, and it isn't with evidence, you can be sure about that. So we've got a strong warning in this passage, three strong warnings, but we've also got an encouragement. Don't be surprised. Keep going in the face of rejection. And I think it's the same for us, isn't it? The same as Theophilus. We can look around in our world and see loads of well-educated, bright, respectable religious leaders who know their Bible, but who just don't believe. Or it could be closer to home. It could be Christian friends who we grew up with, who we started work with, who, again, know the stories. They've got the knowledge. But they've fallen away and they don't put their trust anymore in Jesus. Maybe they say, you know, I've got all that, I understand the message, but my Christian walk has just moved on a little bit. For me, it's more about dot, dot, dot. There's a clear application for us. don't be surprised, don't be spooked when people reject the message of Jesus. It's not for lack of evidence that folks don't believe. So signs and evidence, what are we to make of all this talk of darkness and of light? It's great to sit here, unfortunately, in quite a darkened basement, but it's great to sit here this lunchtime, isn't it, and to spend a bit of time reading and thinking about Luke's Gospel and thinking about the challenge that Jesus has thrown out. It's a privilege to escape the desk and to meet together. Let's be careful that we keep on taking in the light of Jesus' teaching. Let's keep on making time for Jesus in the middle of a really busy day. Let's go on making time to pray and to read the Bible, to prioritise church attendance on a Sunday morning or a Sunday evening when there's a million things to be done in the house, or are you looking to steal a march on the work that's sitting for you in the week ahead, whatever it happens to be for you. When it comes to time with Jesus, I've found it extremely easy to find other things to do, distractions that occupy my thoughts. Let's encourage one another to keep going and to make sure that we keep on getting our eyes tested on a daily basis and go on taking in the light. The dangers, if we don't, are that we drift and that we end up left in the dark. Why don't I pray? Heavenly Father, thank you for this orderly account which Luke has written for Theophilus. Thank you for the warnings, and thank you for the encouragements. Thank you for all the evidence that you've given us to enable us to put our trust in you and to put our lives behind the promises that you make. Help us to keep going, help us to persevere and to go on taking in that light. Amen. Well, do stick around, do chat around your tables. There's a couple of questions for discussion on the sheet. If you don't have to rush away, you're more than welcome. There's even a little bit of food at the back. So thank you very much, and do discuss amongst yourselves.